Chapter 4. At the end of almost a year abroad, we returned home to Katona, and I must say, my sisters and I were very happy to be back. We had missed our friends and all the American things we had grown up with, particularly on the food front. Although my mother still cooked healthy meals for us that we loved, it was peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, the occasional Swanson TV dinner on a Saturday night, a Velveeta sandwich, or frozen Buitoni pizzas that we had been longing for. Given the availability of products from just about anywhere in today's global market, it seems absurd, but in 1970s Italy, peanut butter was basically non-existent. For Gina, Christine, and me, this was outrageous and unfair. We loved peanut butter. We ate it almost every day. Peanut butter with jelly, jam, honey, bananas, marshmallow fluff, or butter, slathered on pieces of extremely white bread or a crusty Italian loaf. In fact, when an aunt and uncle came to visit us while we were in Florence, per our desperate request, they brought a small plastic vat of peanut butter, which my sisters and I fought over for weeks until we had scraped the vessel dry. Peanut butter is not really bad for you, but our other food obsessions like Velveeta and Buitoni pizzas were of little or no nutritional value. For those not in the know, Buitoni frozen pizzas are, or were, do they still make them? Actually, they do. Little discs of dough filled with a paste that is supposed to be tomato sauce with dried herbs and cheese. These frigid pucks were taken straight from the freezer and slipped into the toaster and then into one's mouth. In essence, they were a savory Italianesque version of a Pop-Tart, and we loved them. Why, you ask? They were the opposite of our normal fare. They were like the occasional Swanson TV dinner or the slab of Velveeta on white bread with mayonnaise. They were what our friends ate, and so we coveted them. In hindsight, this is obviously the reason my mother bought all of these things for us, even though they were anathema to her. Yes, they were quick and easy snack foods with which to placate us, but I'd like to think that she bought them so we might feel like we belonged. However, it is more than likely that they ended up in our fridge so we would stop constantly haranguing the poor woman to buy them. With that preface, here's a glimpse into what I ate as a teenager on any given day during the school week. Breakfast. 2 or 3 bowls of cereal with milk, Rice Krispies or similar. 2 pieces of toast with butter and jam or jelly, usually Welch's grape jelly, which is really like sweet purple aspic. Some orange juice. Lunch. 3 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on white bread, usually Wonder, or half a loaf of Italian bread filled with veal cutlets, eggplant parmigiana, or whatever was left over from the previous night's dinner, a piece of fruit, a packaged store-bought sweet, Twinkies, or the like. After-school snack. 1 or 2 American cheese or Velveeta, is it still made legally? Sandwiches on white bread with mayonnaise, or 3 or 4 open-faced peanut butter sandwiches, often layered with sliced banana, a few glasses of milk, another packaged sweet, some fruit. Dinner. 2 or 3 bowls of pasta, and 3 or 4 chicken or veal cutlets, or 2 pork chops, or 2 helpings of London broil. I have only ever seen this cut of beef in America, never in London. I must find out where it got its moniker. Or a lot of whatever other entree my mother made, vegetables, green salad, dessert. Late night snack, 2 of any of the aforementioned sandwiches, or a large bowl of leftover pasta, or any of the leftover entrees, probably sandwiched between 2 pieces of Italian bread. If a dietitian were to count the number of calories ingested and some of their questionable sources, they would be more than concerned for the person who dared consume them. Were they obese, diabetic, depressed? No, it was I. I was very slim, was athletic, had boundless energy, and was always hungry. I did, however, suffer with stomach issues ever since birth, and this kind of diet exacerbated them as the years went by. My stomach. Finally, at the end of my 20s, I discovered I was lactose intolerant and also could not digest sugar very well. I forthwith removed both from my diet and luckily saw some improvement, but still problems persisted. In short, I suffered from constant bloating and IBS-like symptoms. Now, I know this might seem like TMI, but if you are a food obsessive and, due to allergies or a faulty digestive system, eating becomes a daily struggle, then everything else in life can be a bit of a struggle as well, especially as we age. It is proven that our guts are inextricably linked to our brains and hence our moods. If our guts are not functioning properly, then we cannot function properly. I had made attempts at going gluten-free for periods of time and found it disheartening, something I did not feel with lactose or sugar. I tried countless numbers of gluten-free options, most of which did not even resemble what I knew as pasta. Others came closer. Rumo, in particular, is for me the one brand of gluten-free pasta that is able to achieve some of the elasticity and depth that we recognize in regular pasta. But otherwise, in place of my favorite addiction, besides exercise martinis and Marx Brothers movies, I ended up making risotto more often than not, or gnocchi, because they are made of mostly potatoes with a minimal amount of flour. Buckwheat pasta was also an alternative, but, as it has no gluten at all, it really needs to be made with about 40 to 50% white flour in order for it not to become just brittle, bitter strands that instantly fall apart. That said, I love thin, pure buckwheat soba noodles, but in an appropriate broth that complements them. But the really crucial thing is, although they are all viable and tasty options, pasta made from buckwheat, quinoa, corn, rice, lentils, chickpeas, sawdust, or any combination thereof, just doesn't pair up very well at all with most classic Italian sauces. The beauty of pasta made with semolina, soft, or durum wheat flour is that there are myriad sauces that will complement it. Tragically, it is indeed the goddamn gluten that makes the pasta taste so good and function so well when served with something so guileless as butter and cheese or as complex as a slow-cooked meat sauce. Unfortunately, this is an undeniable truth, an absolute, like the earth is round. I will never grow any taller, or we are all going to die someday. Therefore, I don't want an imposter. I want pasta, real actual wheat pasta. Someday, perhaps, a pill will be available to cure the scourge of gluten intolerance, or just intolerance. However, after that little tantrum, I feel it must be said that not all wheat flour pasta works with all sauces. The shape of the pasta is as important as the makeup and quality of its ingredients when it comes to the success of pairing it with the appropriate sauce. You might call it a divine coupling. Italians are very, very, very particular about what pasta goes with what sauce. Only certain salse complement certain paste, and vice versa. This is why in any worthwhile Italian cookbook, there will be at most three different types of pasta suggested to accompany a specific sauce. There have been times when someone in my household, no names, made a traditional family sauce and served it with a completely incompatible pasta. I cannot describe the feeling I have when confronted with this. First, I'm angry at myself for not being able to cook the meal, most likely because I was doing something annoying, like acting. An activity that, frankly, is beginning to wear a bit thin as the years go by. And second, I am confounded that whoever made the choice, no names, does not innately know that, as per example, the combination of star pasta and a meat ragu is an act of heresy. As far as I am concerned, they may as well have just cut out my tongue with a broadsword and danced on the graves of my ancestors. Of course, this reaction is extreme and completely unfair. How could they possibly know the finer points of pasta sauce pairings unless they were raised by an Italian or a food freak? However, when this happens, I take a deep breath, quietly suggest a more appropriate coupling next time, although I vow to myself that there will be no next time because I will be present to stop it, and try not to pity them because they were raised by Philistines. My suggestion to anyone who eats pasta either with or without gluten is, please pair it with the appropriate sauce and vice versa, because you never know who might be watching. Here are a few wonderful and, for me, acceptable combinations of pasta and salsa. Spaghetti, salsa pomodoro con tonno, carbonara, vongole. Rigatoni, beef-based ragù alla matriciana. Ditali, salsa pomodoro con piselli, salsa pomodoro con cozze. To bring greater clarity to the subject of pairing appropriately, or to simply obsess a little more about the mating of sauce and pasta, I would like to share some thoughts on ragu. Ragu. What? Why? How? In French cuisine, a stew made of vegetables, tomato, and sometimes meat is known as ragu. By all accounts, it was the French who brought ragu to Italy, hence the Italianized word ragu. According to the writer Massimo Lanari, ragu was only served as a main dish and not actually used on pasta until the 1800s. It was only then that it became a sauce that always contained some kind of meat and was paired with specific shapes of either fresh or dried pasta. In England, before chefs like Ruth Rogers, Antonio Carluccio, Gennaro Contaldo, and Contaldo's protege Jamie Oliver introduced the Brits to the depth of the Italian kitchen, spaghetti bolognese, or spag bol, as they call it, was basically the only Italian food besides pizza that was eaten throughout their green and pleasant land. But in Italy, you will be hard-pressed to find such a thing as spaghetti bolognese. This is ironic because the pairing of the spaghetti from the southern kingdom of Naples and ragù alla bolognese from the north was created as a culinary symbol of unification after Garibaldi united Italy in 1861. However, today, were that original pairing ever to transpire on any part of the peninsula, especially in Bologna, the cook would be outcast and possibly beheaded. Today, ragù alla bolognese is traditionally eaten in Italy means that if you eat it any other way, you'll probably end up on a watch list, with fresh pasta like tagliatelle or maybe fettuccine. Although in Naples, paccheri is acceptable, I am told. The reason for this is that the richness of the sauce needs a pasta of suitable shape and texture to absorb it properly. Dried spaghetti does not hold ragù alla bolognese in this way and is therefore frowned upon as an appropriate pairing. I have spoken to the great chef and altruist Massimo Bottura about this. He takes this pairing as a personal and cultural affront. Having tried both versions, I happen to agree. I have also eaten Massimo's hand-chopped silky ragù alla bolognese with his handmade pasta, and it defies description. Yes, I will shamelessly continue to brag like this throughout the book. Regarding the sauce itself, it's important to know that the bolognese don't call their meat sauce bolognese sauce. They simply call it ragù. Outside of Bologna, it will be known as bolognese or alla bolognese to differentiate it from other meat-based tomato sauces. And there are countless variations, with or without tomato, only minced veal, only minced beef, a combination of minced pork, beef, and veal, a glug of cream, and so on. However, having spoken to historians and cooked with a chef at the Artusi Museum in Emilia-Romagna, I can say that the truest ragù alla bolognese recipe is in the brilliant cookbook Science in the Kitchen and the Art of Eating Well. This unique tome, published in 1891, was the work of Pellegrino Artusi, a 71-year-old retired businessman who was the first person ever to assemble hundreds of recipes from every region of Italy and put them into a single cookbook. Originally containing 450 recipes, it now contains over 700 and is like a second Bible in the home of most Italians. Artusi's recipe is a mixture of salted pork, ground veal, carrots, onions, celery, stock, salt, butter, nutmeg, and a pinch of flour. Has no tomato at all, and is cooked in about 10 minutes. It was originally suggested that it be served with denti di cavolo, horse teeth pasta, which I have never heard of and sounds very unappetizing, but today it is primarily served with fresh tagliatelle. Artusi's method is purported to be the most authentic way of preparing this now world-famous sauce and the basis of the countless varieties we eat today. Other ragù use no ground meat, but are simply slow-cooked meat-based sauces. Many Italian Americans call a meat-based ragù by the incredibly vague name of red sauce or even gravy. Gravy to me is what you pour over turkey on Thanksgiving Day. How those words came to be used, I do not know. But their lack of specificity points to the homogenization of Italian cooking by Americans and second- and third-generation Italian-Americans themselves. In my household, almost every sauce had a different name, as they were each completely different sauces. On any given day, we would eat salsa maria rosa, marinara, tomato sauce with peas, or a light tomato sauce similar to marinara without oregano, but cooked in a covered pot and not in an open pan like marinara. However, our ragù were a la bolognese or my father's family's ragù. It is this latter ragù recipe that was brought to America by my paternal grandfather's family and was served every Sunday in my home growing up. Although meat-based and slow-cooked, it is still quite soft and delicate, as well as being a very hearty and comforting meal. The base is created with different cuts of meat, such as beef shin, short ribs, and pork ribs, all still on the bone, or even a pig's foot, and browned slightly in oil. Meatballs made with ground beef, bread, garlic, parsley, egg, and parmigiano are fried and set aside with the brown meat. Regarding the meatball, I would say that the key to a great one is good ground beef with a fair amount of fat mixed with an almost one-to-one meat-bread ratio. The bread should be stale Italian or French white, crusts removed, soaked in water, and strained. Meatballs should actually be renamed meat bread balls or bread balls or something like that, but not as stupid, as the proper ratio of both ingredients is the key to their success, according to this palate. Now, the tomato sauce is slowly cooked for a bit, then the meat and its juices are added, and a short while afterward, the meatballs and their juices are incorporated. Like most stews, or ragu, it is best cooked the day before or early that morning and set aside to allow the flavors to gel. It is served with dried pasta, usually rigatoni, ziti rigatti, or penne rigatti. The reason for using pastas such as these is that the rigatti, or corrugated surfaces of ziti or penne, hold the sauce much better than the smooth surfaces of their regular versions. If I were to serve this with fresh pasta, I would use something like garganelli. These are corrugated tubular pasta made by rolling a square of dough around a pencil-sized dowel from one corner to another over a small ridged wooden paddle. When the pasta is ready, the meat and the meatballs are removed from the sauce and set on a separate platter. The sauce is strained to ensure there are no rogue bone fragments, and a ladleful is incorporated into the strained pasta, the rest being poured into a serving bowl, which can be added to each individual serving. The pasta is presented as a first course and sprinkled with grated Parmigiano or grated Pecorino Romano, if your preference is the same as my paternal grandfather's. The meat, which is now so soft it is falling off the bone, and the meatballs are served as a second course on a plate. Never are the pasta and the protein served together in this case. Were I to ever place a meatball in my pasta bowl, they were so good I couldn't wait to get at them, I would be roundly chastised by my parents. I was not only ruining the intended flow of the meal, but it was considered crass, not unlike eating bread with pasta. Meat, unless it is actually part of the sauce, as with ragù alla bolognese, is meant to be served separately, just as bread is meant to be eaten after pasta and only used as a scarpetto, meaning, in essence, little shoe, to mop up any excess sauce left in the bowl. These are the rules that have existed for generations, and I am happy to abide by them as they make sense. Yes, I know there is a difference between dogma and just the way things are because they should be that way, which is also sort of the definition of dogma, I think. But the line between the two is thread thin when it comes to certain things culinary in my family. It was the aroma of this ragù that I awakened to practically every Sunday morning of my childhood. Even today, when I'm with my parents on a Sunday, it is this traditional meal that we share. Here is the recipe for the Tucci family ragù. Ragù Tucci. This is the traditional way the Tuccis make ragù. My maternal grandmother made a lighter version of this same sauce. It calls for spare ribs and stewing beef in this recipe, but different cuts of meat may be added depending on what is at hand. Pork chops, sausage, pig's feet. It is delicious with polpette, meatballs, which may be added to the sauce during the last half hour of cooking. The sauce may be prepared 2 days ahead of serving, refrigerated overnight, and reheat before tossing with the pasta. It may also be frozen with the meat and meatballs. Serves 8. a quarter cup of olive oil, 1 pound stewing beef, trimmed of fat, rinsed, patted dry, and cut into medium-sized pieces. 1 pound country-style spare ribs, trimmed of fat, cut in half, rinsed, and patted dry. 1 cup roughly chopped onions. 3 garlic cloves, roughly chopped. 1/2 cup dry red wine. 1 6-ounce can tomato paste. 1 1/2 cups warm water, plus more as needed. 8 cups canned whole plum tomatoes, about 2 35-ounce cans. Pass through a food mill or pureed in the blender. 3 fresh basil leaves. 1 tablespoon fresh oregano leaves, chopped, or 1 teaspoon dried. Warm the olive oil in a stew pot set over a medium-high heat. Sear the stewing beef until brown on all sides, about 10 minutes. Remove from the pot and set aside in a bowl. Add the spare ribs to the pot and sear until they are brown on all sides, about 10 minutes. Remove the ribs and set aside in the bowl with the stewing beef. If your pot is big enough to hold all the meat in a single layer, it may be cooked at the same time. Stir the onions and garlic into the pot. Reduce the heat to low and cook until the onions begin to soften and lose their shape, about 5 minutes. Stir in the wine, scraping the bottom of the pot clean. Add the tomato paste. Pour 1/2 cup of warm water into the can to loosen any residual paste, and then pour the water into the pot. Cook to warm the paste through, about 2 minutes. Add the tomatoes along with the remaining 1 cup warm water. Stir in the basil and oregano. Cover with the lid slightly askew, and simmer to sweeten the tomatoes, about 30 minutes. Return the meat to the pot along with any juices that have accumulated in the bowl. Cover with the lid slightly askew and simmer, stirring frequently until the meat is very tender and the tomatoes are cooked, about 2 hours. Warm water may be added to the sauce in 1/2 cup portions if the sauce becomes too thick. If you have made meatballs, they may be added during the last 1/2 hour of cooking. The meatballs will soften and absorb some of the sauce. Since expressing those peeves of mine regarding pasta shapes and what sauces they should be coupled with was so satisfying, I'm inclined to confess my feelings about another, even more egregious culinary crime that I've witnessed from time to time. It is the act. I feel my blood pressure rising as I type. Jesus, I hope I'll make it through this without having a mini stroke or worse. The act. Fuck. I'm starting to sweat. The act. Breathe. Breathe. Of a full-grown adult cutting their spaghetti. When I am privy to this act of sacrilege, in that instant, no matter how charming, intelligent, kind, or altruistic the perpetrator is, some of me will hate most of them forever. I will stare, aghast, and sigh, knowing that there is nothing for it. As David Mamet wrote in his great play, American Buffalo, the only way to teach these people is to kill them. However, breaking dry spaghetti, then cooking it and using it for certain recipes is welcomed. Why? I have no answer for you except, as I say to my children, because I said so. Or, really, it's what my grandmother did and it worked, so I do it. Try the following recipe and you will see what I mean. It is my derivation of a recipe I grew up with. I often make a big pot and eat it over a few days for lunch at home, or bring it to film sets as an antidote to the usually horrid food served off a truck to cast and crew by beleaguered caterers. Spaghetti with lentils. Serves 4. 1/2 carrot, finely chopped. 1/2 onion, finely chopped. 1/2 stalk celery, finely chopped. 1/2 garlic clove, sliced. 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, plus more for drizzling. 1 cup dried brown lentils, rinsed and picked over. 1/2 pound spaghetti. 1 1/2 cups salsa marinara, salt, freshly ground black pepper. In a medium or large saucepan, all the ingredients, including the pasta, will end up in this saucepan, so make sure it is large enough. Sauté the carrot, onion, celery, and garlic in the olive oil over medium-low heat until they are soft, about 7 minutes. Place the lentils in another medium saucepan. Fill the pan with cold water to a level 1 inch above the lentils. Slowly bring to a simmer and cook until the lentils are just tender, about 20 minutes. Remove from the heat and set aside. To break the spaghetti, lay out a clean dish towel, wrap the spaghetti in it, and fold over the ends of the towel. Roll, squeeze, and or bend this bundle until you can feel the spaghetti has broken down into 1 to 1 1/2 inch pieces. Place the bundle over a large bowl and unfurl, thus emptying it of all the bits of spaghetti. Bring a large pot of salted water to a boil. Cook the spaghetti until al dente. Reserve half a cup of the cooking water before draining the pasta. Meanwhile, drain the lentils and transfer them to the saucepan with the sautéed vegetables. Add the salsa marinara. Bring to a simmer, cover, and cook until the lentils have blended with the sauce about 10 minutes. Add the drained pasta, along with the reserved pasta water, to make a liquid consistency. Season with salt and pepper as desired. Simmer the pasta and sauce together to allow the flavors to combine about 3 minutes. Serve immediately.